Today is Wednesday, May 30th, 2007, and this is an interview with Mandy Carter. This is our third interview together as part of the series Heirs to a Fighting Tradition, Oral Histories of North Carolina Social Justice Activist. The interviewer is Bridget Burge, me. We are at Mandy's home again, same place in the cozy kitchen on Shepherd Street in Durham, North Carolina. So let's start with when I came in today into the neat entranceway to your this part of the apartment here, the home here. There are all of these boxes and crates of very organized, surprise, surprise, documents. So tell me what you're doing with all those.
Well, the good news is that there's up at the Duke University right here in Durham, there's a Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. And I was asked about a year ago to see if they'd be interested in submitting my papers. And I said, absolutely. And so what I've been doing over the last 6 months has been going through all of my files that I've been working on since I started doing my activism. And what you saw in the hallway is all of my 2003 to 2007 files. And so the way they work it at Sally Bingham, they have this amazing archival process in which they come and they take every scrap of paper you have in your house and they then decide what they're going to take and not take and whatever. But I've been trying to just make sure that I've given them everything I had prior to 2003. So this is the last, and I have to just go through and pull stuff out. But it's preparing for them to take the rest of that stuff. So that's what's going to happen.
Wow. And you said that they often do cultural workers as opposed to activists. What's the difference?
Well, I think initially and Sally Bingham is out of Louisville, Kentucky, and she's part of the, I don't know if I got this right, but I thought it was part of the Bingham, there's this whole Bingham family, Kentucky connection, and she has always been intrigued by women, Southern women, particularly Southern women. And I was always wanting to know the history of women, but most times in the beginning it was cultural workers and or organizing that had a strong cultural bent, like the Civil Rights Movement. In addition to organizing, a lot of it was through song, play, whatever, plays, spoken word. And she's just been documenting Southern women history and culture. And I think what she explained to me, or the people who are doing it through the center, is that they also want to make sure that now they're covering all women, not just cultural workers. So someone like me who has been doing this activist organizing, where in a peace movement and the movement I've been involved with, cultural work has been song, you know, whatever. So they want to just have this stuff available at the center so people can come in and look at who's been doing Southern organizing as women. And I got added to that mix. Now, that wasn't very articulate, but kind of.
It was articulate. And so you're so great about documenting dates,
yes,
and places,
mm-hmm,
and that you've been and that you've spoken and,
mm-hmm,
even places, books you've appeared in. And how did you learn that, and why do you think it's so important?
Well, you know, I know for me it was a personal trait. I've always been obsessed about keeping track. I am such a pack rat. And I remember thinking when I was first getting involved in organizing, what helped me was to go back and look at other people's work. This is like in 1968, 69, whatever. And people then really understood the importance of documenting. The Civil Rights Movement probably did the best job because they were on record. You know, they always kept track of each particular campaign. And through the group called the War Resisters League, they do an annual calendar every year. And because of that annual calendar, that they were always, when you open up a page, any particular day, you would have a reference to some historical fact of the days gone by. And with that, I guess it just put me into a space that whenever I did my work, just track everything. And probably, this is amazing, Bridget, the number one mistake people make when they do any activist organizing, they always forget to put the year on it. Because they think, well, you know, we know it's this year, you know it for that year, but 10 years later, what year did this happen? So I always put day, I always put the month, the day, and the year on everything. And so that's just been a habit. But also, I think with me, it was... the War Resisters League also has their files at a Swarthmore Peace Collection at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. And because they were already doing that out of their national office in New York, we had our office in San Francisco and in Durham, and we would do similar, make sure we had our regional office files that would also go to them as well. So it made sense for us to keep track year by year of what we did as well. All the newsletters, posters, demonstrations, anything we did that was on paper, we kept track of. And I just rolled it over to every place I worked.
Very organized. Mm-hmm. You even type the date at the top of every email you send.
Yes,
even
always.
Though it's on there automatically, you always type it.
I always do it. Just, you know, yeah. And I think that, I mean, and you're right, it's on every email. But I know for me, like when I go back and I have an email history, it's just easier to, like, you know, the date. Sometimes I'll even put the place where I'm emailing from, because I know, like, I was just in San Francisco. And every email I sent out, I always put the date, San Francisco, California, because that's where I was, not here in Durham. It just makes it easier for me, and, you know, maybe I'm anal, but it helps.
We'll say organized.
Yes.
We'll
okay,
say very
organized.
So I just want to, like, describe your kitchen, for example, mm-hmm. a little bit. You've got, so, metal shelves, like shelving,
mm-hmm.
An expensive, thrifty, white, neatly screwed onto the mm-hmm. wall, and you have your spices all neatly mm-hmm. Stacked. So there's a series of a brand that's blue,
yep.
And then below that there's some brand of spices and mm-hmm. herbs that's red,
mm-hmm.
and then you have dried beans and vegetables
mm-hmm.
all in neat containers. Your refrigerator is impeccably organized. You've got the same little shelves beside your sink, and
that's
you have
right.
four little short Dawn bottles, five. It's really wonderful. Every place you look, everything is stacked just so. Your bathroom,
mm-hmm.
it's great.
There was a great quote that I heard, and it's so true. What's the quote? It's like, there's a place for everything and everything in its place. And that has been my mental state in terms of how I look at my kitchen, my files, and in fact, even when I organize, I just think that's so true. Everything has a place, and everything, and there's a place for everything, or something like that. But it works for me, and like I said, they were really happy when they came over, because they've been doing other people's papers, and they said, you walk in, papers were strewn all over, they're not even in any order, and they said, Mandy, yours is so nice, because it's by year, by topic, by project, and I said, yeah, because it helps me, but it helped them too, so.
It's kind of a nice counterbalance to the chaos in the world
mm.
politically and socially, and so it's like you there's mm. some way to have some control, because you're in the thick of just the mess of the world your
sure
whole me. life. So
that's a good way to put it.
I hope it helps you feel balanced.
Yes, it makes me feel very balanced.
Good. Okay, well, so just, I think this is kind of an interesting question. I asked Lou Plummer with his mm-hmm. interview the other day, but when we did a second interview the next day, I said, so did you think about the interview last night? Yeah, definitely. He and Tina, his mm-hmm. wife, talked about it. And so I said, is there anything that you wish you had said that you didn't? Or, and also, is there anything that you wish you hadn't said that you did?
Does that,
I know it's been a while since
mm-hmm.
our April interview, but do you remember thinking anything like that?
Not really. I mean, I have to tell you honestly that when I look at my calendar, like that's, I did that event, short of like, now what it made a difference is to go back and see words that I said, and I go, oh yeah, that was what I was thinking of. I've already kind of moved on. I'm hoping that whatever I'm missing, we'll catch it in these upcoming ones. And there's nothing that I regret. If anything, I really, I'm hoping I didn't leave anything out. That's my fear. I've been trying to be as, intentionally include everything. Because like I said earlier, the thing that I'm struck by now, there's more and more activists coming on. There's lots of them. And my fear is that a lot of them don't really understand or get the importance of documenting. It's just you want to keep things, you want to keep them, but then, you know, document them and pass them on. And or there's a sense of some activist thinking of the lesbian, gay, trans, it's almost like, well, that was then, this is now, and not realizing that it's so important to remember what came before you. And that would also be true for the feminist movement, as a black lesbian. Because I hear some activists today, yeah, that's old hat, who cares? You know, we have all these new ways, and I'm saying, excuse me, but why reinvent the wheel? at least have a respect for those who came before you, because you don't want to walk around thinking we're the ones who came up with this idea. No, you know what I mean? And I just get worried. So there has to be some kind of, I think, creative, wonderful way when you're, especially activists who want to have a sense of learning it or getting trained or whatever and want to know that, that I think it gives them a different sense of humility and thinking, how do I go about my work now? And yeah, you might come up with some wonderful new concept or whatever, but just don't act like it all started with me, M-E. No, it started with you thinking about who came before you. And this has been a major discussion in the women's music era. I'm on the board of Lady Sipper Music, which is here in Durham. And that was started, this is their 30th anniversary year. And they started out very humbly. They were going to hear people like Holly Neer and other women. And they got back home and realized there was no place to kind of get copies of the music of the women who performed at these women's music festivals. And of course, they used the term women's music festival, but it was just chock full of lesbians. Like, no one would call it the Lesbian Women's Music Festival. And then when you realize they came and they thought, what would happen? These are the words that always strike me as how, as an organizer, it really makes a difference in how you think you organize. It's always something like, you know what we need? Or, gee, what would happen if we were to fill in the blank? And when you start with those sentences, because if you think about it, how do we have what we have now? Because someone had the nerve to say, we don't have it, let's go make it happen. Or whatever the existing institution is, it's not quite working right. You try to fix it within that, but then finally someone says, you know what, why don't we just go and have a vision? What would happen if? And out of that, what would happen if around women's music, you have Lady Sipper Music. But there was a time when Melissa Etheridge, I would count as the person who probably, in my opinion, was the, you know, you always find that breakthrough, you know, and Melissa Etheridge, for whatever particular reason in time, she was the one who, as an out lesbian performer, caught the attention of the music industry. The music industry didn't care about the women's music, so what did women music do? They had to create their own label called Olivia. Well, they weren't, you know what I mean? So you start to begin to see that, and when you see that it's possible, and for many years, the women's music festivals, Olivia, there were like five or six women's independent women's music labels. They made a profound impact on the culture of this country. And then when Melissa, quote unquote, made it because she got signed on to Island Record, which is sort of a, either RCA or one of them, whatever, then all of a sudden women said, well, wait a minute. Why do we have to go to a women's music festival? Because here's Melissa who's on Island Records and everyone knows she's a lesbian. Why can't we go there? And that dramatically changed, I think, for the better. But all I hope is that Melissa, once in a while, will tell people, oh yeah, by the way, before me, there was women's music festivals, and I want people never to forget where she came from. You know, so I think that's important. And you wouldn't have that if you didn't have a clear way to look back and see where did it all begin.
So at the end of 1990, you had just finished up working with the Harvey Gantt campaign mm-hmm. in his run against Jesse Helms mm-hmm. for U.S. Senate in mm-hmm. 1990. That year, you were awarded the Mab Segrist Award mm-hmm. by North Carolinians Against Racist and Religious Violence. Mm-hmm. Will you say a bit about Mab and that organization?
Well, Mab is another one of those wonderful women, an out white Southern lesbian activist who has had a profound impact, not just here in North Carolina in Durham, where she's living, was living. But I remember when I moved to Durham from San Francisco, one of the first people I heard about was Mab Segrist. She went to Duke University. She's a writer. She's an activist. She's white. Southern, and she was doing very activist anti-Klan organizing. And I said, I can't believe it. Wait a minute. You're talking about an out white Southern lesbian taking on the Klan, and she's still living? And that's how I met Mab. And she and I have had this interesting relationship over the many years since we've met. It's been kind of a friendly but also kind of sometimes tension-filled. But Mab was around when anti-Klan organizing went from individuals to the structure of this thing called North Carolinians Against Racist Religious Violence, because the Klan certainly was one of the groups. And they formed an organization, had an office, she was on staff. And
can you tell me about what year it was that you met her, and then what year you're talking about?
Yeah, I moved here in 82, so I met her in 82, 83, when I moved here to Durham. She was also active with an organization called the War Resisters League Southeast Office, and that's where I came, moved here to join that particular group. So that's how I met her. But in terms of NCAR, that was more of a, you'd have to almost Google that to see, but I don't remember when they actually formed their office and got, but she was on staff. And MAB, because she moved on from NCAR, one of the ways they wanted to honor and or acknowledge MAB was to form this thing called the MAB Segrist Award through NCAR. And ironically, the other person who also was being honored at this particular event where I was presented that was Harvey Gantt. And just in terms of the practicality, when we organized North Carolina Senate Vote 90, we were what they call an independent expenditure campaign, which meant that we could have no contact, literally none, with the Harvey Gantt campaign, just because of the Federal Election Commission rules. So I didn't really get to see and say hi to Harvey Gantt until that night when I got that award, and even though we had worked all that time, but he was also there.
So what was involved in some of the tensions between you and Matt? Was it political?
Well,
or?
You know, I think it was interesting because, you know, we have such a mutual respect for each other. And I found out later, well, some of this stuff I'm not sure if I should say or not, but I don't know. I think it's when you live in a town. Matt was here before I was. She was certainly well known, respected, did a lot of great organizing, as did a lot of people who were living in Durham when I first moved here in 82. And as someone who had been doing activist organizing in San Francisco since 1969 when I got my first job, I came already kind of credentialed, if you can use that term, in terms of my organizing. It wasn't a philosophical difference. I think it might have been a tension around who knew who was doing work. And I'll share one particular story. I don't care. One of the things that happened when I got here and did a lot of work in Durham, because our office was sitting in Durham, I'm around, I'm at everything. I like to be very visible and very viable. And one of the things that I got awarded was a $25,000 cash award through the Paul Anderson Foundation. Paul Anderson was a gay man, left a lot of money, and wanted his money to be given to five people every year, gay and lesbian activists, to promote gay and lesbian equality. And Mab, when she found out that I had gotten that, somehow she had been contacted, and Mab had given her the impression that because she was contacted about the award that she might have been one of them to receive it. And she shared with me at one point, she said, "Mandy, you need to know that when I found out that you were going to get that award that year, I was in tears because I thought I was going to get it and we were going to use it to put a roof on our house." So I don't know why Mab thought she was going to get it, but whatever that tension was, and I got it, and ever since, that was just an incident. I don't understand what happened with that. She was really unhappy, but that wasn't me. But maybe she felt like, why is Mandy getting this? I've been in the South longer than her. I've been doing activist organizing, and maybe in her mind, she felt it was unfair. But it bothered her enough to share that with me. And also with the Harvey Gantt campaign, when we didn't even have a name for this campaign. I was working with Lady Slipper in 1989. And Sue Hyde, I think I shared this earlier, had come down for some kind of a public forum at the city council downtown and had said something off the cuff like, you know, Jesse Helms is up for re-election in 90. What y'all going to do about that? And we all looked at each other and said, what do you mean us? So we and then ended up being a meeting over in Chapel Hill. Mab was there. Everyone was there. And we said, well, why don't we go for it? And I said, well, I'll take some time off, and I don't know if we can raise any money or not, but I'll be more than glad to give up my time and help coordinate this thing. Well, I did. I left Lady Slipper and told Lori I'll be back in a year, and that never happened. But that campaign took off in a major way. It became nationally known, internationally known, and I think Mab was feeling a little bit like, here we go again. Like, why? And at one point, we were driving up to New York to go to the Human Rights Campaign Fund office because they wanted to talk to us about giving us money. And we were at the meeting, and I'm not a shy person. I was speaking my mind and whatever. And on the ride back, Mab just lit into me like, don't you ever, ever treat me that way again. I mean, there was some tension. It just exploded in the car. And that was the quietest ride I ever had from Washington, D.C. back to Durham. She was furious. And I don't know what happened, but after that, that was like we just had this kind of a, you know, you're there, I'm here, we'll respect each other, but it just went downhill from there. I still don't understand to this day. So I think it was a sense of competition. I also think, and I'll be blunt, that I think that sometimes I think as a black lesbian that there was a sense why Mandy might be gaining more attention as a black lesbian than as a white lesbian. Who knows? I don't, you know. But we've made up, and we just know to the point of where we just know that there's certain things we just don't talk about. We just don't cross that line, and we have a mutual respect for each other. But it was just, it's just, I don't know. It saddened me. And I don't know what else to say.
And also, the piece about the 25,000, the Paul Anderson Stonewall
right.
Award, it's just, if y'all were both pretty well off, it probably would have been a non-issue, right?
But right, but we weren't.
Most people who choose this type of work to be activists and organizers, grassroots especially,
right.
Don't make a lot of money.
That's right.
So what's the most money you ever made in a year? Do you remember?
That was it. In terms of an award?
No, I mean your income, if you don't mind saying, what's as an activist.
The most I made was when I worked with the Human Rights Campaign, because that was a set. When I first went up there, now this is all relative, and it all happened, quite frankly, I got the job at the Human Rights Campaign. They're based in New York, only because they saw what I had, the work I had done with the Harvey Gantt campaign in 90. So 91 went back, I got went by, and I did some work, whatever. But then they said, well, we'd love to have you come and give you a salary and have you work and live in D.C. And I went up there, and I was making, what was I making? I'll have to figure that out and tell you. But it was more than what I've ever made. Plus, it was a steady paycheck every 2 weeks. Working in an office, I've always worked with like one or two people, maybe. Then an office like, 25 people. It was astounding to have an office. You had your own office. You had all the stuff that you normally would never have, and it just blew me away to say, and this is where I'm working now. And also at the same time, I need to tell you that the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force also sat up in Washington, but I took the HRCF job because I knew that I could probably be guaranteed a check. I wasn't sure about NGLTF, and that did more in terms of my economic stability than anything, and I did that for 3.5 years. That's the most I ever made. And that wasn't until I took another couple of consulting jobs. But at that point, that was the most. What was I making? I was making like, in relative terms, really not that much. But for me, it was. I can't remember what else. I have to thin it out and tell you. I have it somewhere. What I made each year for those 3.5 years.
A ballpark, was it 40 grand-ish or no?
More like 25, 26.
And that.
And for me, that was in 1991, 92, I think it was like 20, I think the most I made was like 31. It went from 28, 29, and then each year, the longer you're there, the more you got. But when I saw the salaries of other people, like I was making 31 when I left, 31,000. The executive director of the Human Rights Campaign was making like 60,000 a year. And then that's when I said something's really wrong with this picture. And now they're making like 150,000. These are the executive directors of gay and lesbian organizations in this country today. It's astounding that they would make that much. And there's been a huge discussion about it. But needless to say, someone said, well, wait a minute, they're making 150,000, but people like Jerry Falwell and Paul, whatever, they're making millions, but it's all relative. But I think 31 might have been the most I ever made. 31,000.
So Jerry Falwell and who? Paul?
Pat Robertson.
Oh, Pat Robertson.
Coalition.
Yeah.
If you think about, if you're equating who else are we struggling against and the salaries they make, don't even get into just, like someone like Home Depot who's making what do you make, like 24 million? It's just like obscene,
Or the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina,
what is he
for
making?
Example. Oh, I don't know.
Something outrageous.
Ghastly.
Yeah.
I think
it's just
it out.
So off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, So in January of 1991, you you became the office coordinator for Rhythm Fest.
Yes, Rhythm Fest.
A Southern women's music Arts Politics Festival held on Labor Day weekend. So was that Labor Day in 91? So you started in January and then just a few months later?
Well, actually, I think I'm trying to remember when we started Rhythm Fest, because I think Rhythm Fest, I think we did Rhythm Fest for like 5 years, and we chose to do it out of Durham because there was four other women who came to me, approached me and said, hey, and this is interesting about Rhythm Fest. The reason why Rhythm Fest got formed was that there were a number of other women's music festivals already in existing, a number of them. But there was an undercurrent of a lot of women who were going to these that felt like they were being told, but not you. And people that fit in that category were women who were into like leather, women who were into what you might call politically incorrect behavior. And so Michigan, I'm sure you must have heard, maybe Michigan has a strict policy, women born women only.
Women?
Born women only. In other words, if you're, like, because transgender was coming into the scene, someone said, well, you're not welcome if you're transgender, and even though if you transgendered into female, you have to have been born female. This was a major, major, kind of, it's always been there.
I think it's about to, yeah, the tea's about to whistle. Let me pause a second. I have to push record. So women born
Women born women. And to put it in a timeline, remember I went back and told you about Lady Super Music being formed, which this is this 30 year in 2007, so it was 19, what's 30 from 2007?
77?
Yeah, 19, right, yeah. So in the beginning, when women were thinking we need to find ways to get together and to celebrate all these wonderful women artists, the whole birth of the Women's Music Festival started. And when they started, even though there were lots and lots and lots of lesbians going to them, not everyone was a lesbian, but they never called it lesbian. The Women's Music Festival was sort of a code word for, you know, there'd be a lot of lesbians there. And because it was never a written down women only, but it was called the Women's Music Festival, but as more years went by and more of the G word going from gay to lesbian to bisexual to transgender, a number of women music festivals said, and by the way, when we say women, we mean women born women. And one of the strictest policies of a festival that had that was the Michigan Women's Music Festival. And say what you will, the producers wanted to say, this is a women's only music festival, women born women. It caused a huge political, amazing uproar.
Tell me again the year of this Michigan.
You know, I'll have to go back and see because the Women's Music Festival, they just celebrated their 30th too. I mean, it's not a coincidence that you had all these now 20, 30, 40 year anniversaries because it was this huge cultural up, and a lot of it came out of the feminist movement who didn't like lesbians. It was such an anti-lesbian bias that a lot of lesbians said, but we are feminists, and they said, yeah, but we don't want lesbian feminists. So a lot of lesbians said, fine, you can have your feminist movement, we're moving on to our next phase, which became a very lesbian identified movement. And a lot of that lesbian identified movement all of a sudden then involved culture work, right. So I'd have to go back and remember when that came up. I could probably Google it and find it. I want to say it was maybe 10 years ago when it was that. It caused a huge thing. Anyway, to make a long story short, a woman named Michelle Crone, C-R-O-N-E, that I met through the Seneca Women's Peace Encampment when we did that peace walk back in 1983, and we got to be friends. She was born in Albany, and I was born in Albany, and blah, blah, blah. So she calls me one day and says, Mandy, there's some friends of mine who have been going to women's music festivals. We're thinking about we want to start our own because we feel like there's an uncomfortableness with Michigan, some other women's music festivals, and we thought we want to put a festival on that welcomes all women. And they said, would you like to join us? And I said, I don't know, I just got done with the Harvey Gantt campaign, I'm tired, but you know, this sounds interesting. And so I said, all right, I'll go. And I signed up, and that's how we formed Rhythm Fest. We wanted it in the South. We wanted to use the words women, music, art, and politics. A lot of festivals didn't want any politics, so we said, we're going to do a new festival, and these are going to be the parameters. And that's what we started. And I said, well, I live in Durham. I'm out of a job at the moment. So, you know, that's how I became coordinator. We had an office at 604 West Chapel Hill Street. And that's how we started. But I think we started it before 91 because, remember, I took a job with the Human Rights Campaign in 92. So I think it was 5 years. So it had to have started before 91. But I was willing to be the coordinator in that particular office for that.
Oh, I see. So how, do you remember the first festival you pulled
Absolutely.
Off? How was it?
It was amazing. I had never gone to any other women's music. Oh, no, I did. Robin Tyler. There's a woman named Robin Tyler, R-I-B-I-N-T-Y-L-E-R. She was only the one of the few women's music festival producers who would do one in the South. All of them were either in the Midwest or West. And a lot of us said, well, why don't they put one here? Why don't we, you know? So she had a thing called the Southern Women's Music and Comedy Festival down in Georgia, down in somewhere. And I went for 2 years. And that turned out to be not great. And when she heard that we were starting this thing called Rhythm Fest, Robin Tyler, she hit the roof and said, no one, basically, it's my territory. You can't have it. We said, excuse me? There's not enough room to go around. And so when we did our first Women's Music Festival, we said, well, wouldn't it be natural to have our flyers at Robin's Festival? Well, you know what she said? If I see one of your flyers, you're going to be thrown off the land. I was thrown off the land for having flyers about Rhythm Fest at her festival. And then I said, oh, so I guess feminism doesn't go that far. And we had our first one. It was amazing. We had what? It was held in Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. And we had a number of great, in fact, I have the flyers and posters. I have a whole file called Rhythm Fest. And we had a lot of women come from the South, and we didn't do it on the same weekend as Robin. She always did hers on Labor Day. We always did ours on Memorial Day. So we thought it wouldn't compete. And it was very successful. It was amazing. And it put us on the map. And I got another thing I can add to my name, you know, Women's Music Festival producer. It went really well. It went really well.
Who were some of the performers?
God, I have to look at the poster and see who we had. I don't know if we got any of the big names the first year. We always try to get at least one. I don't think Holly, we didn't get Holly and all those other ones till later. But women, you know, the other important thing to remember is that women's music artists, the only places they could make money were concerts and the Women's Music Festival. So once they heard there was one in the South, a number of them called us and said, hey, when is it? Can you add me to the list and all that? I'd have to find the flyer and see what was on there. But
so you charged people to enter the festival on
Well, the other thing we did, we challenged the culture of women's music festivals. All the ones that you went to, you paid a certain amount of money, and when you got in, you had to wear a band. And we said, we're not going to have any bands at this, any wristbands, you know. And we also did, like, sliding scale. I mean, we actually got kind of radical about it. They said, no, you have to do it this way, that way, and well, no, we don't care. And then also, if you're a worker, you got a different distinguished band, and somehow you were elevated. And we said, now we're going to be just like everyone else who comes. You know, we're going to work it. I had to end up working the box office to computer. And when we got doing our, when we, at the end of the day, rather than sitting in some special section where the producers and all, we just sat with everyone else. We tried to just de-emphasize this culture of hierarchy and all that. And it was the first, people came and said, what, there's no bands? You don't want us to be wearing bands and you're going to have sliding scale? Are you for real? We were, and it worked, and we made money. Didn't lose any, and more people came the second year. And the hardest part, though, was land. It's so hard to find land for an event like that. You have to have insurance. You have to think about the security of people going, women. Women like to take their clothes off, and where can you do that and not worry about whatever? And it was so hard to find land every single year. And then by the fifth year, we just couldn't do it anymore without land that you own. So it stopped after 5 years.
Yeah, it's, can you talk a little bit about the politics involved in the language and terminology of around sexual orientation and identity? So, for example, you talked about how first it was just gay, mm-hmm. and then lesbian, mm-hmm. and then bi, mm-hmm. and now it's LGBTQ for queer or questioning.
Right.
And now there's pansexual, mm-hmm. and
And intersex.
Intersex.
Right.
And so what, maybe you could just talk a little bit about...
Well, you know, I think... Excuse me. What's been intriguing to me is how, if you think about women and gender, and don't always think about women in terms of like male, female, but there's so, I think what's happened is that there's been such a diving into understanding, trying to explain and or articulate the real uniqueness of what makes a woman against the backdrop of this concept of orientation and identity. Because it used to be just sexual orientation. But I think that as more women who are feminists, who got more like feminists into lesbianism, into really trying to understand about this orientation and identity, people just got more and more specific because there were so many unique experiences. And I think people kind of could say, rather than just the G word, everything was gay. Well, can't we just be called gay? No, you can't, because it's just too much variation. And what we found within the lesbian culture against the backdrop of these women's music festivals, it was interesting about how policies got set at these music festivals, kind of based in a really interesting way, based on the producers of who's doing them, on their own politics. So I wish I could have been a fly on the wall to have been sitting in a meeting with the producers of Michigan. Michigan is the single largest women's festival in this country. I mean, 10,000. I mean, we're talking like a city. And the producers of that, a woman named Boo and some whoever else, Lisa, at what point did they have a discussion and say, well, we'll take women, straight women, we'll take lesbians, we'll take bisexual women, which for some was a problem, but we're going to draw the line at transgender. If you weren't born female, then I'm sorry, you're not welcome here. But what was going on in their mind that became such an issue that they put down the, you know, whatever? And I think for a lot of people began to realize something, which is why I'm fascinated about activist organizing. You know what they said? We can either sit here and try to find a way to fit into their, or you know what, we're going to say, you know what, thank you, but we're leaving. And so when Michelle Krohn, who had gone to Women's Michigan, and the other producers, it was like Barbara Savage from Tennessee and Kathleen Mahoney from L.A., who actually introduced Melissa to the whole music scene, these were women who were veterans of the Women's Music Festival and said, you know what, we're not happy here. What would happen if we took and started something on our own that would allow this? And that's how we came with Rhythm Fest, only because of a dissatisfaction. But also they were willing to say, but we're going to add the word politics into ours because we do want to believe in politics. And so they were the first festival to put the word in there. And they also said, we're willing to be more open about how people self-identify. And so we didn't have a transgender issue with Rhythm Fest at that point. That didn't happen to us, but it was happening with Michigan. But I think more and more women were willing to say, but I want to say, I am this, I am da-da-da, and I'll even further describe who I am. And I think every time people would kind of further explore their own identity, then you began with words like transgender, then pansexual, then intersex, because it was just getting more and more clearer. And why not use those letters? Someone said there's too many letters. Not in my opinion. If you need to add letters onto it, add them on. What's the difference? You need to really try to understand people's lives, who they are, what they believe in, and all that cultural stuff that goes around that. And that has been so rich. And for those who have a real issue with it, people, you know what? People self-select out. They're not interested. Don't do it. But don't stop those who feel like they really need. And I've just been so excited about that. And to my opinion, right now, in terms of the lesbi, gay, trans community, transgender activism is at it's just happening in a major, major way. It's very exciting. So, for those who want to be risk takers, go ahead, because there's room for you too.
What's exciting that's happening in the transgendered movement?
One, the acknowledgement of it. Two, the acceptance of it. And three, the legal change is happening. You might have heard about the mayor out of, not the mayor, but the manager out of Key Largo, Florida. Man for 18 years, married with kids, who was town manager of that town for 18 years, and finally said, you know what, I need to be honest with myself. I need to have a sex change because I now want to become a woman. And the townspeople heard that and said, oh no, you're not, and they fired him. And he said, but I'm the same person that was, they said, no, but you're not a man going to become a woman. So the National Center for Lesbian Rights took on his case, and they're now taking it to court and saying it shouldn't be based on whether he's a man or a female or a male. It's whether or not he could do his job correctly. And they just got a major win with something that's going to take him to the next level of a legal challenge. That's unbelievable around transgender. It's incredible. So, but I also think, look at TV. Remember the movie Queen Priscilla of the Desert out of Australia? Remember that? That was drag queens. Then we had our own version of that with Patrick Swayze. It was called Chu Wong Fu, I Love You, Julie Newmar. And look at the actors in that. You know, Wesley Snipes, male, straight black actor. That was one of the... Have you ever seen that film? And when you think about that, you think, culture, look at the shift that that made. I mean, I'm getting chills about it. So I think sometimes you can't win. Sometimes you go the legal route, which a National Center for Lesbian Rights, Land Legal, they're doing that. But then you go the cultural route, and sometimes that cultural stuff just is so amazing. And now, on the cover of The Advocate, did you see it?
In your bathroom?
Yeah. John Travolta and Queen Latifah are going to do the remake of Hairspray. And how groundbreaking was that when Divine, you know what I mean? So it's like people are going, but wait a minute. Yeah, what's wrong? So there's it's just, God, it's just happening in a major way. It's so exciting. And everyone now uses LGBT and Q, but there was a big struggle to add that T word in there. But now it's like, it's just part of what it is. It's just so amazing. It's great.
So between 1992 and 1995, you had several key roles with different Democratic campaigns.
Yes.
So let's start with, you touched on this a little bit, but let's start with when you became a staff member for the Human Rights Campaign Fund.
Right.
As the Southeast Field Coordinator, mm-hmm. but you worked in the D.C. office.
Right.
Right. So tell me what some of your roles and responsibilities mm-hmm. were.
Well, first of all, the Human Rights Campaign Fund, what was interesting about that organization, they started out to be just a gay organization like a lot of many groups did. But there was one of their members who said, you know what, if we're going to make change in terms of the United States, we need to be thinking not only of a change of hearts and minds about who we are as gay and lesbians, that's what they used back in then, gay and lesbian. He said, but if we don't start thinking about who are the lawmakers and who's making these laws, if we don't figure out a way to come up with a strategy for having a base in Washington, D.C., where the Congress met, that if we were to figure out as a gay organization, that if we shifted the focus into working on Congress to try to change some laws in addition to hearts and minds, this might be an avenue, which really was the whole basis and foundation of the Human Rights Campaign Fund. And which is why they sat in Washington, which is why they did a whole kind of activist organizing around how to become a lobbyist. How do you go and lobby Congress to start changing specifically the civil rights law to add the words sexual orientation to what already existed as civil rights laws on the protection of race, religion, whatever. They said, let's figure out how can we add the words gay and lesbian protection in Congress. And that was the sole reason why they formed. So by the time I joined them in 1992, one of their main jobs was to create lobbyists, to train lobbyists to go and lobby the Hill. But because I came from the South, all of my assigned members of Congress were Southern. So any Southern congressman or woman, I was their lobbyist. And I used the term lobbyist, and they didn't use the word lobbyist. They came up with the word public policy advocate, because lobbyists seemed, and even back then, have a bad name. But as a public policy advocate, the one thing I will thank the Human Rights Campaign Fund for was, one, to actually go and walk the halls of Congress. Have you done that? Yes, you have. Bridget, I had been doing activist organizing up until that point, and I cannot tell you the impact that that had. Just literally walk over to Congress, walk in the, you know, there's like three different, like there's three different House office buildings, and then there's U.S. Senate. And to me, all I knew was that big dome thing that we see when we think of Congress, because, you know, you have the U.S. House on one side and the U.S. Senate on the other. But I didn't know anything about all these different Raybon House office buildings. I learned all that. And I remember the first day I walked in the halls and I was going to my first visit, I said, wait a minute. How many activists do I know that have never stepped foot in any of these buildings, because they've always done organizing in the streets of D.C., which is good. But if they don't figure out how to add walking the halls of Congress to their larger political activist organizing, I said, that's the missing link. And for me, it was like a light bulb went off. And I remember walking, and I said, wait a minute, aren't they here for us? But I realized they've done such a fantastic job. You feel like the U.S. members of the Congress and U.S. senators, you feel like that you're at their beck and call. And they said, wait a minute, aren't we paying their salaries? They're here for us. But the thing has been so turned around that when I went to my first visit, I said, my attitude changed. Like, I'm going to go visit whoever it was from North Carolina, and I'm going to walk into that office, and I'm going to say, you know what? You're my representative. I'm your constituent. And the power dynamic just shifted in my mind about that. And that, for me, was like, that was amazing. And that's why I think anyone who ever does activist organizing should go to a lobby day, whether it's in Raleigh or up there, because it does just, it's just dramatically. Anyway, so I did that for, God, a couple of years, and I learned how to lobby. You know that backpack that I carry, that red one? When I first moved to D.C., I used to carry my backpack into when I did lobbying, and someone said, no disrespect, Andy, but I think you might want to get a briefcase because that's not the code of how we look. And I kind of got into that whole thing and how you dress up and, you know, how you write and whatever. It was great. I mean, that was a very exciting couple of years for me to do that. And also, more importantly, meeting specific members of the Congressional Black Caucus. That was very important. And as one of their few black folk on staff, that was also one of my assignments. And to be working with the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, oh my God, such respect. And remembering there was a time when there was no women, no people of color in Congress, and thinking, wow, what an impact they had. And the gay cause, the Human Rights Campaign had a great reputation on, reputation on the Hill, and I thought, if anyone can walk in and if you just say, hi, my name is Mandy Carter, and I'm here, and I'm here representing the Human Rights Campaign Fund, and see the look of, oh, yes, that didn't come from nothing. That came from a lot of respect and building those relationships and having a track record. And I thought, yeah, HRCF has a very pivotal role to play. That was the upside. The downside was all the time that I was at the Human Rights Campaign Fund, even when it changed into just Human Rights Campaign, it was a predominantly white staff. There was just a handful of us of color, and yet they kept on talking about more, being more and more inclusionary. But by the time I left in 95, I pretty much had had it, because I said, you talk about more people of color inclusion, I'm not seeing a whole lot, but also people of color inclusion that can make decisions, not the person who's the receptionist, not the person who's the bookkeeper, not because you look like you have diversity, but who in this organization, really of color, has an impact not only on what you believe in, but also brings a racial kind of overlay dynamic about what policies you're going to try to work on, who you're having your relationships with. And it just got to be so disappointing to see, yeah, we're going to do it, and it never happened. And I must thank Suzanne Farr, who came to visit me one day in the office. We went and had lunch, and she said to me, Mandy, what are you doing here? You have such skill and talent, and you know, have you thought about, you know, you've done your thing here, but you might want to think about taking your talents and going elsewhere. And guess what I did? I finally said, you know, at one point, it was Elizabeth Birch, who was then the new incoming executive director, first woman ever at the Human Rights Campaign. And one or two incidences when I was working at HRC really kind of put me in the position of, I'm ready, but Suzanne just had those magic words at that moment to say, but why are you here? And at HRC, when Elizabeth Birch came on in her administration, you know, first ever woman, it was exciting.
She a white woman.
White woman.
Of course.
Had firmly worked at Apple, and out lesbian, that was good. But I saw that when she came in with her sense of vision, she had such an opportunity to have made such a major difference at that place, but she kind of fell back into the same old, and was trying to do one-on-ones with all the staff to have these conversations. And I said, you know, Elizabeth, we still haven't had ours. I never had my one-on-one with her. And during that time, you might have remembered Newt Gingrich, his cousin, or wait a minute, his sister, but not by, anyway, his sister came out, Candace Gingrich. And HRC had this interesting thing, because they had the most money. And anytime someone came out and they became known in the media, who do you think would go and grab them and have them become their human rights campaign? So Candace Gingrich would get signed on as the special role or something like that, and they're organizing a tour for her. And they said, well, we certainly need to have her go down south. And I'm saying, and where do you want to have her in the south? They said, well, Duke University called and they wanted to have her come speak. And I said, well, I live in Durham. And wouldn't it make sense if I were the one to be the person to introduce her, be there, go down with her? And what do you think they did? They didn't. And they chose another white lesbian who actually had the hots for Candace and wanted to get this thing. And I remember I didn't get this and I said, that was the last straw. How can you sit there and say you're going to put Candace Gingrich, whatever, in the state of North Carolina, in Durham, in my hometown, and I'm not the HRC person going? He said, that was it. Because I said, apparently you're not getting it. And they said, oh, yeah, we're going to have her go around the country. We're going to make sure there's people of color and all this other. It never happened. And so I said, the problem is you're a rich, white organization that has money as its prime tool. And what are you doing to change that? And here you have this huge opportunity. The media was everywhere on this. And what did you do? You did the same old, same old. And I thought about what Suzanne said, and I said, you know what? I went and said, Elizabeth Birch, I said, I'm out of here. I'm sorry, I just can't do this anymore. And she said, but Mandy, why? And I told her, but it just went over her head. And when I decided to leave, I didn't do what some other people at HRC had done of color. A person of color who used to work there would leave, they would make a huge big thing about it. Like, let's embarrass the human rights campaign. Let's make them look like they're shit. I didn't do that. I said, I did my 3.5. I'm glad I was here. I learned so much. And I said, you have such potential, but you're just not doing it. And I just can't do it anymore. And I left very quietly. Came back to Durham in mid-1995 and then got myself ready to work on the second Mobilization 96 campaign when Gantt ran again. But that was that time, and I said, boy, they just had such, but they're still, it's the same rich organization, bought a building, have a staff of like 100, handful of people of color staff, and nothing's changed to this day.
Where does most of their funding come from then and now, do you know?
A lot of rich gay and lesbians who have a lot of money, and they were willing to pour it into this organization. Not as much funding from foundation. They didn't have it. I mean, there is a very large population of gay and lesbians who have a lot of money, and the place that they put most of it is into human rights campaigns. So they were never having to worry about funds to this day. I think what's happened, fortunately, I mean, I think there's been some good change since then, but what's happened is that, Bridget, the other thing that was going on during this segment when I joined them in 92 until I left in 95, there was a world in which when you talked about the gay and lesbian movement, there were two organizations that you almost had to go through and or get okay from: the Human Rights Campaign Fund and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And a lot of people living in states and counties said, well, wait a minute, isn't there another way we can organize that we have to be, are they the only ones? So we began to question how policy or how whatever issues. Someone said, well, who's making these decisions? Oh, yeah, HRC and NGLTF, but we live in North Carolina. Why can't we make ours? So more and more people began to think, why don't we start our own statewide organizations and think about how we can then work with, in partnership, with NGLTF and HRCF. And that was another wonderful kind of change in the air about how organizing happened. So it was an interesting time frame of that, but that's what happened.
Yeah, it strikes me that a key lesson that you've mentioned 3 or 4 times just in today's interview is how some sea changes occur because people think outside the box, mm-hmm. they take a new look at power relationships, mm-hmm. and are creative. Mm-hmm. Why not us?
Absolutely.
Why not now? Right. I don't like that. Let's mm-hmm. do it different. And it seems like it's a key of liberatory action, I guess.
And I would also add to that, I think the other dynamic that happened was, I remember being as an organizer, and you might have seen this too, that sometimes when you work within an organization or a project, things aren't going the way you want. People would almost find ways to undermine it. Like, if it's not my way, then I'm going to make sure you have a hassle. But people said, wait a minute, why take that energy and find ways to undermine and or hold up or get in the way of, just say, thank you, it's been great, but then take that energy and take it and then go create something out of the box. And I think that was another shift of just how, what I saw, like, active political organizing happening in this country. And that just gave people a different feeling. And some people were looking for, but is it okay, or do I need to check in? No, you know, just, you know, you just start up because you think it's so important. There might be one or two of you in the beginning, but there's so many groups you can point back to now that had there not been those courageous one or two who said, I just got to do it differently, or let's just try something different. And you think about how that is just such a positive, creative, exciting, sometimes on the cutting edge, this made a difference. And people said, yeah, let me put my energy there. I mean, now, I'll go back to this lavender menace that was going on around feminism. When this whole feminism started happening, this feminist movement, and clearly there were lesbians all over the place in it. And I remember now having this issue of, well, we don't want to have now identified with lesbians. And so they actually had this incredible kind of a, what they call the lavender menace, you know. If you are, don't tell anyone, or you know, oh no, we're not lesbian. And
Can you say a little bit more about the lavender menace? Was this a phrase that now came up with?
Well, no, now didn't. I think a lot of people who were, well, I lived in California. Before I moved, I lived in California and organized there from 1969 with the War Resisters League Southeast until 82, until I moved here to Durham. And even at that time, now is very active in the state of California, very active. But this whole concept of, you know, feminism, it was just happening. And why? The word feminist came out of the fact that so many women were involved in the anti-war movement that was so male-dominated. A lot of women said, I want to find out how I can find my voice, my particular way of working on this as a woman, because they were kind of being kind of like not paid attention to from the anti-war movement. So a lot of women said, well, wait a minute, then we'll look at the feminists. Let's look at issues around gender and whatever. So anti-war movement moved into the women's movement, feminist movement, only because they were feeling like not welcome in the anti-war movement. They formed their own, but then they turned around and didn't like the idea that so many left. So every time you got a new thing, it was like, we're happy to be here, but we just can't handle you being here. And I said, how many times have we heard that, the anti-war movement, so male-dominated? We're happy women are here, but, you know, but this is your place. And then women go, all right, we're out of here, form their movement, and then say to lesbians, but, no, sorry, and then lesbians get out of it. So you see what I mean, like this, da-da-da. And I think with now, because now is becoming this power force. I mean, look at that, you know, and Gloria Steinem and all that. And what was the point? What just asked me about something about, so now we're saying, you know, and we don't want to have any sense that we're any lesbian because we'll get bad media. Well, now it was just so full of lesbians, it was unbelievable, but a lot of them said, but because of the reality of trying to be viable and being taken seriously, if we can just put a lid on that lesbian thing, we'll be okay. Well, putting a lid on that lesbian thing was called the lavender menace. I mean, people were saying, but I've been with now, I'm active, you see, but not with this, you're not. Now it's going to complete turnaround and come around understanding it, but in the beginning they were so worried. And so a lot of lesbians said, well then, you know what, we're not welcome here, we're going to go form our stuff, you know, and that's when you start getting like the lesbian movement.
What's the significance of lavender?
Oh, because purple, lavender, I mean, you talk gay, everything's gay. And so lavender menace was meaning gay, lesbian, gay, because at that point there wasn't L, it was just gay. So lavender was gay, right? You know, purple. That's what they meant, lavender menace, lesbian concern about now. That's where they came up with the word.
I want to go back a little bit to the Congressional Black Caucus and HRCF.
Mm-hmm.
What was their relationship? Do you want to take a break?
I'm going to take my vitamins with my banana.
Okay.
That's okay.
Let's take a break.
Stretch my leg for a minute.
Record. So, once again, during our break, we start talking and it's juicy and wonderful.
I guess we should have just left it on.
Yeah, we should just leave it on. So, say what you were saying again.
Well, you know, what I was saying was, I was just back in San Francisco and contacting a number of the folks who I went with to the very last session, 1968 summer, of the Institute for the Study of Nonviolence, and next year we're going to have a big 40th anniversary year reunion. And when I was out in San Francisco, I was talking to some of the folks that are going to be a part of this, and it struck me, and plus piggyback onto the interview we're doing, is just how can you ask people, thinking particularly of the AIRS Project, not only their personal journey about how they individually and personally got involved in their journey for their activism, but against a backdrop of the journey of activism in this country. And what I was saying was that for a lot of us who are now in this 60s generation, demographically 78 million born post-World War II, that when I got engaged in the movement, I got engaged in the movement because someone from the American Friends Service Committee and the War Resisters League, I got involved with, because that was the whole anti-Vietnam War era. But what was interesting though, as in the anti-Vietnam War era, it was very male dominated and very white male dominated. And I was just saying that what I found intriguing is that one reason why I think we got a feminist movement or the women's movement, because a lot of women felt not welcome in the anti-war movement that was so male-dominated. So they formed this thing called the women's movement. And then there was also a very kind of anti-lesbians within the women's movement that then formed a lesbian movement because they weren't, I mean, so if every time you have a movement for change, and these are all movements for change, and they're looking at people that are everyone but you, sorry, and whoever that everyone but you, sorry, becomes the next phase of a movement, women's movement, feminist movement. We met in the feminist movement, they were saying everyone but not lesbians. And lesbians said, well, I can either sit here and put up with it or try to make life miserable for you, or do I, as a lesbian movement, take our movement and make that a thing? But then the lesbian movement, some of it said, but we don't want to have any women who aren't born women, so they're anti-transgender. Then the transgender, I mean, so it's like this incredible, incredible journey. And so to ask people who are self-identifying as social justice activists as part of the AIRS Project, I said it would be neat to have this conversation about what was your journey against the backdrop of whatever the journeys were of our social justice movement. It would be absolutely intriguing to me. I'm just so fascinated by it, because my question is, as we think about new movement organizers or social justice organizers, how are they doing it differently? Do they even care what came before them? Do they have some new ideas or ways in which they're being becoming organizers? Or if I were to start an organizer's training school, what lesson would I learn from all that? You know, personal journeys, social justice journeys in terms of this country. And I don't know, I'm just looking ahead and thinking, wow, that's intense. That's pretty intense. That's pretty cool. So that's what I was saying.
Yeah. So let's go back. I want to hear some stories about the relationship between HRCF and the Congressional Black Caucus. So let's see, what's a succinct? Well, just go for it.
All right, I'll go for it. Well, one of the things I must say, that when I came and joined the staff of the Human Rights Campaign Fund and became a public policy advocate, the only African-American one there was there, certainly one of the things I was asked was to work specifically with members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And one of the things that we found out is that in terms of the voting record on the gay and lesbian issue, the one single caucus that was the most consistently with us was the Congressional Black Caucus. And why? Because everyone I would talk to, and they would say, you know what, been there, done that. Because if you're sitting here in this office talking to me about you being a gay and lesbian, trying to get equal rights, I will tell you that take out the words gay and lesbian and put in the word black, and then we are on the same path. We have been down this road. And so I think there's been this wonderful, interesting kind of partnership between black members of Congress because of the whole civil rights struggle around race, and here we sit in our civil rights struggle around issues of orientation. However, what I have now seen, however, as those years have gone by, is making sure that a lot of the what I call the white lesbian movement doesn't make the mistake of at some point thinking that being protective of orientation or gender is more important than race, because you end up competing with and or undermining the work of racial justice work. I'll give a classic example. Kentucky Fried Chicken in Louisville, Kentucky, has a great policy around gay and lesbian non-discrimination. So you can be a gay and lesbian employee at Kentucky Fried Chicken and you're fine. At this particular Kentucky Fried Chicken chain, a black worker had been let go. And it turns out he was being let go for not any really good reason. And people in the community were trying to organize some kind of a support effort for this particular young man, black man, who had been fired. And they thought that because the black community and the gay community kind of got along, that would be great, until someone in the gay community said, but wait a minute, do we want to jeopardize our protection at Kentucky Fried Chicken to stick our neck out for a black man? And I said, oh my gosh, we can't go down that road. But that's happened more than enough, because all of a sudden what becomes more important is protecting me as a gay person than understanding we need equal protection for all, whether it's on race or orientation. And that turned out to be a very negative situation. In other words, gays were saying, well, I don't want to jeopardize our protection for being gay just to stick up for some black guy. And we said, excuse me? We need to stick up for each other based on race and orientation. And I don't want to see us, as we continue down this road, having to pick and choose. Second example. New York State had a Republican, I'm sorry, Al D'Amato. Was Al D'Amato Republican or Democrat? Senator Al D'Amato. I can't remember. I think he might have been Democrat. We'd have to check on that. Anyway, Al D'Amato, he was up for re-election. But he had... And even though he was good on the gay issue, very good on the gay issue, he was bad in terms of a woman's right to choose, and he was bad in terms of people of color. And so the Human Rights Campaign, on their own, decided they were going to endorse Alphonse D'Amato, despite the fact that the people of the state of New York said, don't do it. We have to challenge Alphonse D'Amato in terms of his issues on gender, with NOW, National Organization for Women, his issues around the woman's right to choose. And so a lot of people said to HRC, you can't stand up here and endorse a man and tell everyone they should vote for him when he's not good on choice and or people of color. And they said, but wait a minute, all we're concerned about is he good on gay stuff? And we said, excuse me, that's the problem right here. And the Human Rights Campaign ignored the people who live in the state of New York and said, basically, we don't care, we're going to endorse him. And everyone else was going to endorse his opponent. And I remember, born in Albany, New York, they were having a special Human Rights Campaign fund, Human Rights Campaign town meeting in New York around this endorsement of theirs of Alphonse D'Amato. I went up, I had already left the staff, and I went up, and what I brought with me was a Human Rights Campaign award that I had received. And there's another woman named Barbara Smith, black lesbian author Barbara Smith, who helped co-found Kitchen Table Press, who had also received the Human Rights Campaign Fund Award in the past, who also is from Albany, New York. She couldn't make it, but she said, Mandy, I'm going to send you my HRC award. And what I did was, at this particular meeting, town meeting, I stood up and said, the Human Rights Campaign used to be my family. I worked there for 3.5 years. And I said, however, I must tell you that as a black lesbian social justice activist, I cannot believe you're going to sit here and continue with your endorsement of Alphonse D'Amato. And I walked up and I turned my award and Barbara Smith awards over to Elizabeth Burtz, the executive director, and said, I'm returning these because community means too much for us to believe that you could, as HRC, continue on with this endorsement. And guess what? Alphonse D'Amato did not get reelected. But that was probably one of the most important, I think, conversations in the gay movement was, do you simply say it's more important to support gay, someone who's gay supportive, than it is about choice or people of color? I said, that's the choice you all have to make. And I think that was one of those moments. And since that meeting, they said, you know what, I think we did blow it on the endorsement, because we just can't talk about just gay only. It cannot just be only about gay. It's got to be gay and people of color and women issues. So that was one of those moments for me, and that's what we got down to.
You look like you still feel a little angry.
I think more, I'm not angry, I think just saddened. I mean, we had been saying this over and over and over again, and yet it was almost like their attitude was, basically, we don't care, we have enough money, we don't care what you all want to do. We can afford, this was the attitude, we can afford to do whatever we want because we have the money. And I think at that moment, Bridget, what I was saying earlier was that at some point you... as a movement, you realize if it's only about just being gay, that won't cut it. And it almost took that drama of this endorsement and this real schism for the movement to say, you know what, it is about not just only being gay. If we don't figure out about the connections, and especially with the African American community, who has been so supportive of the gay movement, but they were saying, but we want to put ourselves first. And that lesson was, no, it's got to be an and situation, not either or, but and, A-N-D. And things have changed since then. But as someone like me and others felt really in a bad position at, like, you know, going up against all this power, but you know what? That didn't matter. That was a valuable lesson. But I also thought it got into this issue of when do you let states decide for themselves how they're going to function? Because HRC, based in Washington, said to the state of New York, who said, no, don't do this. And after the motto lost, New York said, can you now respect our space? And that began what I think was this trail toward autonomous, independent organizing, state by state, and still work with or have conversation with Washington, but not like they can't dictate. So that was one of those, another moment, in my opinion.
I'm struck by how many social change groups and individuals still struggle with the intersection of oppressions and feel, for example, the organizing, and we were on the planning committee for the Fayetteville, the anti-war demonstration in March in Fayetteville, North Carolina, in 2004. Mm-hmm. And I guess specifically 2005, there was a lot of controversy on the program committee about whether or not the country cowboys, right, the country kings could, which were LGBTQ veterans, are they veterans?
I don't know. I don't know if
they're veterans. I think they're just LGBTQ young folks could perform or not. And then, there are anxieties among some people about this is about anti-war stuff. Mm-hmm. This isn't about gay rights. Mm-hmm. And so that's just another example of, and I'm thinking of North Carolina Women United.
That's
and
right.
You and I just co-facilitated a retreat mm-hmm. for their board of directors, and they're really struggling with, ironically, mm-hmm. They made a statement that they felt like a lot of predominantly black organizations didn't support gay rights, mm-hmm. which I think... in some ways is a racist assumption because history goes to show
as
that it's
think.
Been very different.
Absolutely.
But there is a tension there. So mm-hmm. I'm rambling a bit. I'm not sure what my question is here, except to say that it still is a real ongoing challenge. And I guess one of the things I hear organizations say is we have to be targeted and strategic. Mm. So we can't be everything to everyone. Mm. So what I guess, I'm, you know... Tell us the right answers.
Mm-hmm. Wondering about the right answer. What I find interesting is that I think if we all look back, and I'll speak as a me statement in terms of my work, what I'm really struck by is this idea that somehow that there's always been this schism between single issue organizing versus multi-issue. That's just been on the table for so long. And just like you said, we can't be everything to everyone. We can't do all this work. But I'm thinking that might be in terms of what's your underlying philosophy. And I know for me, I think my introduction to nonviolence and nonviolent activist organizing in this style, what made a huge difference for me, and it came to the American Friends Service Committee, certainly the War Resisters League, was this idea that if you take the principle of equality and justice for all, those equality and justice for all, five words, if that is your underlying primary premise, then it's almost like no matter what the particular issue or project or year, if that's your underlying philosophy in politics, then you're going to be much more able to adapt and be flexible enough to do the work. But if you start out with the principle, we're only going to do women's organizing in the state of North Carolina and that's it, then you can see how problems would come up. And as I understood it, one of the things, a woman who was a black woman who was on the board of NC Women United was not happy about their pro-gay position. But when I looked at this mission statement of NCW, there was not one very put in print word, gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, it wasn't there. And so you could argue the point that if you're not going to be very specific and put it in writing, then you can see how someone would say, but I didn't know that's what y'all were working on. I don't see it in there. And so, I don't know. I'm just thinking that this is my theory. This is how I feel like I can organize, and it might be how other people have been, and there's been examples. Rather than trying to be the end-all, be-all organization for everyone and everything, what if you look at my particular group's going to take this particular segment of activist organizing, but I'm going to work with you who's doing this particular segment. So if you have this cooperative model of how all of us can take segments that we know that we're great at and can be so good at and focus on that and then work collectively and work in unity, that puts a whole different model on the table. So I don't have to be the end-all, be-all women's organization. I'm going to take a segment of this, and I know I'm going to go and work with this partner, that partner, whatever. So that on the surface. But the other thing is, in this country, the demographics are changing so dramatically in the United States of America, demographically in terms of race and class. And what North Carolina looked like when North Carolina Women United first started, and it wasn't called that, it was called the Women's Agenda. Look at the demographics of when that was to where we are now in 2007. You have more people of color, not just black, Latina, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, so on and so forth. And if you don't factor that into who your audience is or who your issues are going to be directed to, and if you have the model of basically, can I be honest, white women, and white women either middle class or whatever, there's no way it can have an impact on what you're trying to get done. So I'm just wondering, when I think of being a North Carolina activist, I love this state. If I were to venture out as an individual and look for something I'd be excited about, the glasses I would look through and the prism, this is what I look at. Folk of color, are there any? What's the class of the folk that I might be working with? Are they going to be inclusive of issues of gender? And which is one reason why we started Southerners on New Ground. What could we do? So we said, well, we're just like one group, but what would happen if we were, as a small organization, to talk about transformative models of organizing that connect race, class, culture, gender, identity, against the larger backdrop of justice? We're now in our 14th year, and it seems to work, Bridget. And I'm just thinking that it doesn't be our particular group, but I think people just see it differently. And boy, it makes a big difference in terms of what kind of work you get done. And I think that's a great model.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say I was joking about tell us the answers, but you did it brilliantly anyway.
No, this is like my A version. My 2 cents worth. I'm sure there's other 2 cents you can throw into the pot.
Oh, lots of them, right? Yeah, so it's just, you know, you still hear that, and lots of different movements and struggle this thing around specifically the single issue organizing or multi issue.
Yep.
And there's a lot of either or and less creative thinking around both and.
Yes.
And the model that you
I love
were
it. Yeah.
Talking about. Yeah.
Can I go back to the Country Kings for a minute, though?
Yes.
You know, there was also before that issue about them performing at the Fayetteville rally. Also within the lesbian community, I was talking to someone, I think this is purely generational. When she heard about the Country Kings spelled C-U-N-T-R-Y, she said, I can't believe a group would even use a name like that. And then you go to someone else and said, that is so radical, that is so great. So, like I said, even within our own lesbian community and movement, you have different degrees of what's acceptable or not. And she was like, I'm outraged. They're putting their name on a flyer. And she's a lesbian, too. And I'm thinking, what's up with that?
So. And then the the Vagina Monologues with Eve Ensler,
yes,
there's a whole segment about reclaiming the word cunt.
Yes.
And so...
Perfect. Exactly. Like, what's that?
Yeah. Okay, so I want to go back again. I've got a long list of notes here, Mandy, mm-hmm. that we could talk for years, I think. But there's a bill that was just recently got a lot of news in the North Carolina House about trying to add sexual orientation into the hate crime legislation. Mm-hmm. And was Song involved, or have you all or any group that you're involved with now weighed in on that?
You know, I think we're Song, because we're a nonprofit, we don't do any political work, but I remember when we were working with, Safe Schools, North Carolina Safe Schools, and we were talking about all this issue of adding that language. It was a combination of this particular language around hate crime, but also in high schools about this bullying thing, which I thought, I think that passed, didn't it? Did you hear? I thought they had said that there was some particular language around anti-bullying, and that went through.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's it.
Adding bullying, sexual orientation,
yes,
to the laundry list,
yes,
of groups that often get targeted,
right,
by bullies.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So we did have a relationship with North Carolina Safe Schools, and we supported that.
And that's Melissa Weiss.
Melissa Weiss. Uh-huh. Right. Exactly.
She was the former executive.
Right.
Director
exactly.
There.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me, what year was Song founded, and who, 14 years ago, what's mm-hmm. that year?
Well, the conversation about starting Song was in 1993, but 1994 was the first official year.
And who was involved in that conversation?
The six women were Mab Segrist, Suzanne Farr, Joan Garner, G-A-R-N-E-R, black lesbian out of Atlanta, Pat Hussein, which I think you have on there too, black lesbian out of Atlanta, Pam McMichael, white lesbian out of Louisville, Kentucky. Did I already mention Suzanne Farr? And myself, six of us. We're the six co-founders. And we purposely wanted to have three black progressive lesbians. We call ourselves three black southern black lesbian progressive, whatever. We wanted to make sure we had the word progressive in there, and then three white, intentionally. And now we're 94. What is that? Wait a minute. Conversation in 93, started in 94, so 2007 is our 13th year, going into our 14th year. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it came out of this conversation of, actually it came out of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force 1993 Creating Change Conference, where we did see sort of this within the gay and lesbian movement, this sort of anti-Southern kind of thing, but this turned out to be an amazing effort, and I think a great model, and a lot of us have moved on. We have two new staff people. People are still around, and I'm surprised how many emails we'll get from someone. Yeah, you know, you're one of the few groups that not only is Southern based, but as a white out activist, I feel so comfortable knowing that there's a group that believes in this very bridge building model, and you know, you're more into, like I said, the race, class, culture stuff, but like a kind of a welcoming, not like it's okay to be who I am. Because I know there's a lot of groups who are either predominantly people of color who don't want to work with white folks, or white folks who don't want to work with people of color, and that's a tension, but Song has always been about, why not? I love it.
Tell me more about the story of Song. How did you first become a nonprofit, and what were some early pieces of work,
mm-hmm.
and how were decisions made, and all the...
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we did the, before we started thinking about starting the group called Song, what is now Song, the people who came to this 1993 conference this little hand thing is vibrating. There you go. We already knew, all of us already knew each other, right? So Suzanne Farr was there, Mandy Carter was there, Joan Garner was there, Pat Hussein was there, Mab Segrist was there, and I don't know if Pam McMichael had come or not. So we already knew each other's work because we're all Southern based, so that relationship was there. But what made the two things that made us kind of come together and have this conversation after the Creating Change Conference is that Mab Segrist did a keynote at this particular gathering. And her keynote, which we have in print, really challenged this idea of being gay and lesbian activist against a backdrop of economic justice issues, particularly in the South. But then we did a workshop, Pam and myself and Suzanne, whoever, we did a workshop about being Southerners organizing in the South with a social justice agenda. And between Mab's keynote and what happened with us in the workshop and this general attitude of like, why are we here in the South? Do you have regular food there? I mean, you know, we said, wait a minute, why don't we talk about at least having conversations about what could we do to get this different idea about strategizing and organizing. So we had a retreat, I think, in Louisville, Kentucky, at this place called Hopscotch House, started by Sally Bingham, going back to why my papers are going to Duke. And we sat down and we said, wait a minute, you know, we're all doing work, we don't want to move, and can we figure out some group or something we can start? And we started messing around with the possibility of starting a group. And that's, we had conversation, and we had two or three retreats about that with all six of us. And we all came to the conclusion that, yeah, maybe. And at that point, I think I was not employed. So I said, well, can I be the first person to help? But I didn't become paid staff. It was Pam McMichael in Louisville who got an office. We wanted a co-director. We talked a lot about models of how you organize. How do you start an organization? How do you not do it top down and all that? And Pam McMichael started a song office in Louisville. Pat Hussein started a song office in Atlanta, Georgia. So they were like co-directors, and they got it going. And the first couple of projects that we tried to start off were things that were local enough that people could get involved with. And the name Song, I think this might be myth by now, but I thought Suzanne Farr had, we were all talking one day and we thought, well, what are we going to call ourselves? And someone says, well, the South has to be in it. And you know, the South, in terms of civil rights organizing, always talked about song and culture and how they organized. And we said, song, well, can we come up with words that would fit the acronym? Well, then there's always the stuff about the old South. Well, what if we talk about the new South? New? Southerners, new, and where are we? So Southerners on new ground, I think. And you know, what was interesting is the first few years, because we had Pam and Pat working, and I was already doing work, and Suzanne was employed, and Pat and Pam and Mab were really hard on just keeping this vision. And we'd meet regularly and talk about what's going on and what the work was. And at one point we were at a retreat, and it was one of these, is it going to just be about us at this point? Because clearly what started out to be a black-white dynamic, which mirrored kind of the old, you know, the South of black-white, we said, you know, things are changing now. It's not just black-white. And can we only talk about being women? And so one of the first things we did was talk about getting a male, gay man, on the board. And we thought maybe a gay man of color or not. And a lot of us thought, that's kind of scary. We just like, we're so comfortable with each other. But what about really getting serious about changing? And that changed. And then also I think the idea of having a male co-director. So we got a black gay male out of Atlanta, Craig Washington, to be taking Pat Hussein's spot. That was the first time we had a male, black male. And then we thought, is it just about being lesbian? We added Matt Nicholson, who was a gay man who identified as, I think, trans. So I can't go through every year, but it's just been an interesting growth or an interesting journey. And also, quite frankly, the age stuff. I mean, I was the youngest and Suzanne was the oldest, and we thought, is this age dynamic going to work? Are we not talking about younger? And so we kept on questioning ourselves and kept on saying, you know, we have to be open to this. We can't just be trying to keep our hands on this thing. And then in 2003, I ended up getting the job as executive director for 3 years. That was great, but it was like a lonely job. I was by myself down in this office with no windows.
In Durham.
And that was actually because the first offices, one was in Louisville, one was in Atlanta, and then in 2002 we moved the whole office over to Durham. Everything's now here in Durham, and we closed the office, and when I left, we're going to probably reopen it, but it's not been open. So, you know, we're hired two new staff people, getting money in and trying to reopen that office, and they're doing great work.
So, well, let's just stick with the song story mm-hmm. for a little bit longer. I know we've skipped many years, so we'll go back, but just since we're here. So what was involved in your decision to become executive director?
Well, quite frankly, what was going on with Song was that we had, at that point, three staff, Kim Deal, Akiba Tamoya, and Rebecca Silver. And they were the current staff in an office in downtown Durham. And Kim Deal decided that she really needed to move on because her partner got a job down in Florida with a union and put out the word that they were looking for, you know, a new person. And it wasn't really the director at that point. They got rid of the word director. I think they were all trying to be like co-staff. They were trying to do this kind of model of no one person in charge, everyone has equal responsibility in Kim's position. Oh, go ahead. We were going to say
so that was Elise Gowdy, right?
Yes.
And was it with IUE CWA?
I want to say was it SEI? What was it with, that she was going down there for? I thought it was SEIU. No. What did you just say?
Well, IUE CWA is the local union here at Local 188, and she was working with NCOSH at
right.
the time, and also the president, I think, of that union. But it we can figure it out which union it was.
And you're right. I'm not sure which union it was. But
sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. Cause that's good to keep it on track.
Okay.
And so Kim's whatever her development coordinator, I think. And I said, gosh, you know, I had just wrapped up doing some work with Evan Wolfson around this whole Freedom to Marry, and I said, I was doing that as a consultant. I thought I'd like to get a regular job again, you know, like a paycheck, right? And it's in downtown Durham. I thought I'll apply for it. A lot of people applied for it, and fortunately, I got it, the development coordinator job. But when I got it, I had said the first thing was, well, is there financial security with this office? Oh, not a problem. Well, unfortunately, there wasn't. And I have to be careful how much I say or don't say here. So let's just put it this way, that the financial reality of what I thought was what I was going to walk into was different than the financial reality of what it was. And so what started out to be a staff of three, Kim leaving, me coming in to keep that staff of three, ultimately because of financial realities, we got cut down to one. And the board at that point kept me as the sole staff. And at that point, we didn't know how long I was going to have to be there as a sole person, keep the doors open, keep the work done. And we had a huge number of responsibilities with grants we had gotten. So Kim moved, Rebecca Silver rotated off staff, Akiba off staff, she moved back to San Francisco. And rather than just using the term coordinator, we had a little bit of a conversation about using the term executive director. But I said, you know, there's a number of groups that we work with at Song, and keep on using the word coordinator goes so far, but if I can use the term executive director, that just has a different, you know, different, I don't know what word to use, a different way of how people respond to you. And so I said, I'll start using it, director, and went coordinator, director, executive director, because this is incredible annual executive director retreat that happens every year. It's always held in Laguna Beach, California. And this is the executive directors of every single national LGBT group in this country. It's major. And I was invited to go, and I've been going to it for a few years. Anyway, to make a long story short, for 3 years, we never had enough money to hire another additional staff person. And I did it for 3 years, and by the time that third year was done, I was just like, you know what? We need to do something, because I just cannot do one more day in that office. You've been in that office, but no windows. We were doing great work. It wasn't like work wasn't happening. It wasn't in a major way. But I was also at a point in my life where I just didn't want to just do that. I said, I've got to get out of here. So I gave my notice and put the word out, and we got who we have now, Paulina Hernandez, and my mind's going. We might have to stop for lunch. Caitlin Breedlove. Have you met them?
Caitlin, yes.
And you haven't met Paulina?
Okay. No.
Mm-hmm. So they're, and we got, and then all of a sudden, you know, we did grant writing, and Mab's a good grant writer, and Suzanne is, and got a chunk of change, and we're now okay.
Congratulations. Well, let's take a break.
Yeah, because my mind's going.
Yeah. I do that.
Okay.
Well, we just had lunch and we've decided we're going to call it a day. It's a 90 degree North Carolina afternoon and we're just going to take it slow and meet again for interview 4 of the series. Okay.
Cool.
Cool.